Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Hi, everyone. This is the Rose, Rose Colombo, right here for you.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Listen up because it is Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday, God willing, from noon to 1 p.m. on the West Coast in the good old USA. But people can stream it online once it is archived, and you can hear it around the world. And thank you, everyone from around the world in foreign nations who do listen to Colombo Chronicles Live, that is archived and taped live. We don't archive every show, but we do archive many shows. And the shows range from guests who are authors and experts, prominent people from around the nation. A few have been from around the world, who talk about current events and wars, Holocaust, love, romance, animal rights, human rights, and masks and goggles and gloves and COVID and all kinds of interesting news of the day and issues of the day. But today we have a little change of pace. I thought it would be fun to have a guest who is a returning guest. She hasn't been on the show for a while. And I wanted to welcome her back. Her name is Judy Watson. She wrote a wonderful book. It's called Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. And it was narrated by Richard Arlen to Maxine Coolish and edited by Judy Watson, who spent the time and made the effort to bring this beautiful book to us about many, many movie stars back in the day, even up to the starting with the silent movies and up to the current time, where many movie stars, believe it or not, were very poor, and they became very wealthy. And then many movie stars, producers, directors, and agents who were very wealthy sometimes became very poor for a myriad of reasons. And those untold stories are intriguing. And Judy Watson is going to share her book with us and some of those wonderful stories, Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. Again, it's narrated by Richard Arlen to Maxine Coolish and edited by Judy Watson. Let me tell you a little bit about Judy Watson and her achievements. Judy Watson was born in Chicago, Illinois, and has lived in California since 1947. She is a graduate of Arizona State University, where she majored in literature. She has 2 grown children and 3 grandchildren. She currently lives with her 2 dogs and 3 cats in Westlake Village, California. And this is her first published book, Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about her book when we come back from this important message, and then we're going to speak with the dynamic Judy Watson. So don't touch that dial. I'll be back in just a minute.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car... Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion? Not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics. From politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up. Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc. Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up, because now we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts. And we do have an author and expert. Her name is Judy Watson. And again, she was born in Chicago, Illinois, lived in California since 1947. She's a graduate of Arizona State University, majored in literature. She has two grown children, three grandchildren. She currently lives with her two dogs and three cats in Westlake Village, California. And this is her first book, Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. And I want to start out just reading her introduction, part of it, just a couple paragraphs, so you get the gist. The introduction says, in 1955, Horace Height established a 10-acre luxury retirement resort community in Sherman Oaks, California. He named it Horace Height Magnolia Estates Apartments. Horace Height had been a pianist and big band leader on radio and television in the 1930s and 1940s. He established the sprawling complex for musicians, actors, and writers, those people whose lives and fortunes were connected with the entertainment business. It was lovely. Four swimming pools, the Aloha Room, where entertainment and wonderful dinners were held, and an executive golf course where tournaments were hosted. Judy's mom had lived there for 40 years. It was now April 2008. She had her final collapse 3 weeks after her 94th birthday in March. And the reason I wanted to mention this, Horace Height Estates, is because Horace Height Jr. took over the estates. Every year he has the most beautiful Hawaiian luau ever. And every year my friend Horace Height Jr. invites me to attend his luau, and I always try to attend. He has some celebrities there, and some celebrities who retired still live at Horace Height Estates. And he's also a musician and a singer as well, and he has a big band just like his dad. And after the luau, they play big band music, and you can dance to your heart's content. It is just lovely. It is beautiful. Under the stars in the evening. And the other reason I wanted to mention this is because I read online in a news article that Black Lives Matter and Antifa had actually went to his facility and allegedly vandalized it, the Horace Height Estates. And I just want to say that we have to stop the violence, and we have to stop them from destroying properties that are actually a landmark and can't be replaced. And neither can the people who live in the facility be replaced. So I want to ask the governor of the state of California to stop promoting and supporting a Marxist organization and a communist organization that commits anarchy, and when it gets close to home with our own friends who own landmark facilities and has helped people in the entertainment industry for decades, that it's time to step up to the plate and do the right thing. Protect the American people who are law-abiding and paying taxes and paying the wages of the governor, the mayor, and all legislators, and we do not want our police defunded. And on that note, let me say and welcome Judy Watson, the dynamic personality returning with her book Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. Hi, Judy. Welcome back to Columbo Chronicles. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm so glad you said what you said about Horace Height. One of the things that I don't think people know is how much work he has done throughout the years with the Chamber of Commerce, how many awards he has received, and he's always working to establish a better life in the San Fernando Valley, and his apartment does not discriminate from anyone or to anyone. And for them to do this is absolutely disgusting. And I'm really glad you addressed it head on, because most people are afraid to say anything. And I do watch Governor Newsom as he panders to the liquor business, as he panders to anything, the drug business, as he panders to those people who like to go out there and use their First Amendment rights to protest. And he never speaks or addresses the violence and the destruction all of us have witnessed. So thank you, Rose. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. That's what I do.
Well, most people don't. People try. People, I think, are afraid. I mean, that's why writing the book was really a great pleasure, because it took us back to another time.
Judy, where it's more of an all-American time, and the struggles of many celebrities who actually were poor when they came to the USA or were born in the USA, and they had this opportunity. And I think, I look at your book this way. I look at it like these people knew America, whether they were born here or were immigrated here, knew the opportunity that America has for everyone, but it takes hard work and motivation and desire and consistency and persistency to reach your American dream. And so I wanted to talk to you about this book and these entertainers and people you've heard about or known, because it's very important that we remember the difference between communism and Marxism, where there are no opportunities, and America, where there is opportunity. So thank you so much for being with us today. And I read that Maxine Fay Coolidge was born on March 18, 1914, to a wealthy Jewish family. So can you tell us what significance she has with your book?
Well, my mother was that other woman. That's the way it was described, you know, Rose, because if you weren't, she was a Katharine Hepburn. Basically, she was, because she took care of Dick until he died. She was his best friend, his secretary, his publicist, his assistant. They were together as long as he lived until the end. And he meant, I think he just meant the world to her. He had no money. You know, he was very wealthy at one time, and like many actors, he lost everything. And therefore, I've often given a lot of thought to why he narrated his life to her. And I think it was the only gift he had left to give her. And I quite believe that he felt his name alone would help her get this book published, but it did not. She had rejection after rejection after rejection. Nobody knew her. She didn't know anybody in the business. And that is why I decided to do the book. I thought the stories were so interesting. The book itself only encompasses maybe a quarter of all the different narratives and stories. And I had always hoped to do another book, but I still think about it because it was just one wonderful story after another. And but interestingly enough, my mother's family, my grandmother came from very poor immigrants, as did my grandfather. And they worked hard, and they began to make money. And in the period with which my mother was growing up, they were quite wealthy. However, my grandma, parents, why my grandmother would do this, we never knew. But she divorced him because he was an adulterer. But, hey, who did that in those days? And she subsequently lost the beautiful home my mother grew up in. So my mother fell into poverty with my dad. And my father was really the American dream because he came from nothing. I mean nothing. And then we came to California, and he went to work in what was then the growing Southern California sportswear business. And he became wealthy. It was interesting to watch the cycle of her life go down and my father's life go up. And I always felt that I was in a place where I got to see so many things that happened in the early stages of those experiences. But meeting Richard, I think, was for her that entree into the place where she always wanted to be an actress. And in the period in which my grandmother had a big house, they had a theater on the third floor of the house, and they put on plays, and my grandmother directed, and my grandfather had an orchestra. Their whole life was art, and my mother's life was always in the theater, always in that place. And I think for her, Dick was the epitome of the dream she never had. You know, very sad in a lot of ways.
And in your book, you say they met at Weddington, a golf and tennis court in Studio City in 1963, and her third marriage had ended. And this was the place where all actors hung out in those years. Isn't that interesting that the actors hung out at golf and tennis courts? Because when you look back at the old movies, there is a lot of scenes where the actors are at country clubs, golf courses, and tennis courts.
Well, the Weddington family owned it, and unfortunately, I think they've sold it. But they allowed an old actor named Jack Kirkwood to come in. And while Kirkwood was alive, they allowed him to run the golf course and the tennis courts. And I think because he was an actor, that drew many actors. I recall going there myself, and man, you could look up and down where people were hitting balls, and there's one actor after another. Not big-time actors, but those people who made a steady living. Because don't forget, you know, the Valley was the epicenter of the studios. Universal Studios is in Studio City. Warner Brothers is in Burbank. you know, and Paramount was just around the corner, and they were large, and many, many people worked in the studios in some capacity or another. And that's how I grew up. I have friends who were child actors. Their parents were writers, directors, producers. It was not uncommon if you grew up in San Fernando Valley back in the 40s and 50s to find that about 2 out of every 3 people worked somehow in the studio. That was a huge business then.
It's interesting because you also say that in your book that the pictures of them were in a photograph book that he bought for her, and the card nearly tucked in read, "For you, darling, love, Dick," and the photos featured the two of them on the small golf course at Horace Heights holding hands at a dinner party and in front of her apartment. It was a match made in heaven, except for one problem. Richard was married.
I think Richard liked to get married. He actually, when he met Mother, he was in his third marriage. And it's not a funny story, but she got religion. She became a Catholic, and therefore he did try to leave her. And he was unable to because she became very religious and refused him a divorce. And that was it, you know. And she had that right because there was no such thing as no-fault divorce in those days. And he was tied to her for the rest of his life. But his spiritual love life was my mom. And I think that's a very interesting part of the whole dynamic of their relationship. I found a lot of love letters and cards. And my gosh, she was lucky to have that kind of affection and love after 3 failed marriages. That's pretty nice to have.
It is, and what's interesting that you just stated was that there was no-fault divorce, and a lot of young people who may be listening may not know that you could just not file for divorce and get a divorce until the 80s, and that when no-fault divorce was enacted, and that before that, you were married for life because most of the judges, I'd say 99.9%, were males. And if the husband did not want a divorce, you could not get a divorce. Or, you know, even no matter what the situation was, the judge would tell them to go home and make the best of it and put the marriage back together. And so it was a totally different situation. So I understand why you said he could not get a divorce.
Well, my mom's first marriage to my dad, that was pure adultery. My father had a mistress. I don't think he ever tried to fight her when she said, no, it's over. And he did marry his mistress. That was my stepmother. And then the second marriage, that was the worst marriage. We were so lucky because we found out he'd never got a divorce from the wife before my mother. So that marriage was null and void. And in the third marriage, now there's an interesting story. My great uncle stepped in and took over. My great uncle was in the mob, and he was very wealthy. And associated with
Dvorak. He's in the mall.
Yeah, and Marvin Mitchelson, and I don't think David was going to fool with him, you know. And in David's case, David was a very on the borderline schizophrenic man, and he became very physically threatening to Mom when he lost his job. And AL came in and took over, and Mom got her divorce. But that's where money comes into the picture. That's a fascinating story. My great uncle is actually in a book called Supermob, and I got to read all about it.
You have a very interesting family. I'm related to the Colombo mob. Hello.
Yeah. You know, I mean, always we discussed, was AL in the mob? We all thought so. But, of course, we couldn't prove anything. And I don't know if you remember the Sister Kenny Fund, but that was a Catholic charity that he ran. He developed the charity scam of which the Clintons took over, and many people have taken over, in which they learned to have so many expenses that very little money goes back to the cause. And in this case, he made $11 million for Sister Kenny, and he kept 10. God. Every time I think about that, and I thought, well, that's pretty good because he actually gave him 10%. But they took him to court and they won, and he went to jail for a very brief period of time and went back to his mansion in Bel Air where he lived the rest of his life. And that always gave me my absolute belief and theory that, you don't get rich by being honest.
You know? No, it's true. I mean, everybody in, not everybody, but so many people within the political arena we know are very dishonest and they're very
correct, wealthy.
my
great uncle, listen to this. I mean, one day my mother, when she was married to her third husband, said, "We're going out to AL's boat." All right. So AL kept a boat on the marina, and he had a captain on it 24/7. And the purpose of that was because the chancellor of UCLA liked to go out for a ride on the boat. And I have no idea why or how that association went, but I know that he gave millions to UCLA. He had two children. I'm going to assume they went to UCLA. I don't, or relatives, somebody went. And that was back in the days when this was a normally accepted thing, that you could give these kind of gifts to UCLA. USC was famous for it, and it was just accepted. And if you got a favor in return, wasn't that nice?
The other little story you tell about is years later at Mom's memorial, Horace Jr. asked me how Mom was able to rent there without adequate credentials.
Yeah, that's a great story. And I found a piece of paper. I don't know where I put it. Richard and Horace Height Sr. were great friends. And I'm going to say that Horace was absolutely wonderful to me because he grew up with Richard living there, and all Dick Van Patten lived there for years, and Dick was friends with everyone. Dick was worried about my mom, wondering if she could pay the rent. He knew he could not. And he went to Horace, and he said, "If you will allow Maxine to stay here, I will do free advertising for you." And when you used to go into the Horace Height offices, there would be a revolving pictures going all around the top, on a screen on the ceiling, and they were all of different actors who lived there, and Richard Arlen's picture was there and stayed there for years after he died. And that is how my mother got to stay there. But Horace Jr. was a boy. He was a little boy. He didn't know my mother. He didn't know how she knew Richard. He didn't know anything. And he says to me, "How did she get to stay here?" I thought the funniest thing about Jr., now we're friends, was that he knew nothing about me. He didn't know my husband had worked in entertainment and television 50 years. He didn't know my brother was an illustrator in the movies for approximately 40 years. He didn't know where we could come into, because at that period, Horace was strict, and you could not live in there unless you were in the business. And what happened, which was very sad, was that Horace was taken to court for discrimination and age discrimination, and it all ended. But in the period my mom lived there, and I'm going to say until she died, that did not exist. And it was just a very interesting place. I would go to the dinners. If you lived at Horace Heights, you might get a break on your rent, but then you had to perform. You are a performer. You performed. And Horace had many, many dinners. They were always wonderful, inexpensive dinners. I saw Roberta Sherwood perform. I just thought she was marvelous. And I saw so many famous composers, singers, the King Sisters, people just, and everyone got up, took their turn, and performed. That's how it was. It was delightful.
Yes, it was. Yes, he always has wonderful performers, and the thing is that it's good public relations for them as well, because people today have cell phones and they videotape everything and put it on the internet. So it's also good free advertising as well.
I was thinking about the cell phones. Here's what I was thinking for people that don't know that era of Hollywood. My husband was a cameraman 50 years in the business from the very beginning. And in those early years, the television studios were run very much like the movie studios. And they had full departments that had professional photographers that went out and recorded events and people and stars and shows. And that's what is missing today. And therefore, I donated those pictures to the UCLA Film Archives for students to study. and also how the camera was created and the advent. The camera starts out as a large, bulky, black and white camera that has to be plugged into a wall, and it ends up where it is today, a minute camera that you can put on your back that works on batteries and has full color. But that was an evolution. There was no such thing as tape. I worked at Channel 5. When I came in, tape was in the early stages. Everything was still black and white, and the telemobile had just been created, and the helicopter was about to start. And people don't understand. This is how it was. And they had a full department of people who wrote, people who painted sets, people who created flats, photographers, and helped in all the development of the early stages of how television was created.
Isn't that interesting? Because a lot of young people have no clue. You know,
no, they
probably most of them, because they feel so entitled. Anybody can be a celebrity now, and or a talk show host. Just go online, you know. And
they do.
So
I've never watched one, and I probably never will. But you know, but I feel badly for them. And sometimes I write things on Facebook. You know, they'll show me a person who looks like they just got beaten up with earrings all through their hair and their, you know, rings through their nose and their eyebrows, and they'll say, "Isn't it wonderful that my small granddaughter, this woman writes, is so nice about this?" And I said, "That's because she's 4 years old." You know. Maybe you need to explain to her what real people look like. And because why should we evolve into a society where we don't even look human? And but
yes, I'm sure a lot of people agree with that. And the other thing is that the television and the movie studios have changed, because in the 1970s, I went to Universal Studios. That was, of course, a long time ago, you know. And they took us through this studio, and they showed us a video of what was coming in the future and why there were going to be fewer actors and actresses, and it was going to be more difficult to get jobs in the movie industry and television. And they showed us these animated clips that looked like humans, but they weren't humans. And lo and behold, they're very popular today.
Well, my son, you know, works in television. So does my son-in-law. They work in animation, as a matter of fact. But that's still something that's not so... They can use it for animals, like, you know, effects and things like that. But they have yet to perfect it for people. But I do think that what actors don't realize is that with animation comes the ability to do voiceovers, which is a very difficult field. You can't just stand up there and become something. And you act, you know. And I think that animation opened up a huge door for actors. Let's say you didn't like the way you looked and you knew you couldn't get a part. You weren't tall, you weren't dark, you weren't handsome. But you can do 50 different voices. Hello, You're going to work.
My daughter has a friend who has a beautiful voice and a beautiful singing voice. And she does the animated talk. What is it called, talkovers?
Mm-hmm. Voiceover.
Voiceovers, and she does a lot of them. You know, they call her all the time, and she makes a good living doing it. And
like you said, that is
an opportunity.
Yeah, I don't think my daughter has a friend. She's really cute, and she's Barbie, as in Barbie doll. You know, she's the official Barbie doll. Yeah, but she also can do others, and she works steadily doing voiceovers. It's a good business. But like all of that business, it's who you know, it's connections, it's having people like you. And I think there's a lot of anxiety in it now, because there's been all this opportunistic takeover by the LGBT people and by Black Lives Matter, a lot of, you know. So I have to say it's got to be very insecure to work in Hollywood now because the studios no longer exist, Rose. There are, you know, one of the things you can go back and you can denigrate the studios and talk about the Jews who ran the studios, but they were interested in making a product that had a story. They were interested
in... And they made
in,
excellent movies.
Correct. And good actors and storylines. But
well, look at them. I mean, I still watch them. My kids watch them. My grandkids watch them. I mean, once I got them hooked on these stories with, you know, people like Clark Gable, Cary Grant, Paul Newman, all they like, my daughter called me. She said, "Mom, who is that man?" I go, "What man?" She goes, "Most handsome man I've ever seen." I go, "In a movie." And I said, "Well, what does he look like?" She said, "Oh, he has beautiful blue eyes." I said, "Oh, you must be talking about Paul Newman." She says,
right.
"Oh, I'm in
you
love."
You know, Paul Newman came off the Broadway stage. I don't know if people know that. But he was a fine, fine actor. And that's what I watch. I do, too. I have to admit, I watch Turner. And because I like the acting.
I
and
watch
then
all
when
the
I,
movies.
You know, it's like, oh, wow, it's great to see a character actor that can actually act, you know. And because what we see is, what you see is the continuous. I mean, do you know how many channels there are and how many streaming things there are? So it's a huge market. Many actors can get jobs. But I don't know that they have the training that qualifies them to really be good actors.
I think that there's a big difference, too, in the writing because there's not very many like I Love Raymond, which is a classic to me. It's so funny and so clean and just so, you know, American. And
well, I'm going to interrupt you and tell you that, because you should do that. Go and look this up because I can't remember. But when I came into television, don't forget it's the late 50s, there were standards. And there were standards that just went away. Television studios had to do so much public work. They had to have certain standards. They couldn't show certain things. They couldn't speak certain languages. I mean, everything has gone.
Oh, yeah. I went to Catholic school, and they had a rating system, you know, and it was on the movies where it was like for kids or adults or X-rated. Now everything's X-rated, and I really can't watch some of the scenes. I have to go get up and go get something to drink or, you know, do something until the scene is over because there's some scenes I will not watch. And the movie's good. Then all of a sudden they pop up with this crazy, either total violence or people just doing weird things, you know. And I'm like, we already know how to do it. We don't really need to see it done. And the difference between the old classics is they were so – it was more mysterious, and it kept the mind going because they'd stand there with this beautiful negligee on, and then, you know, it was like the woman would walk into the bedroom, and, you know, and then the guy would be standing there, and you knew what was going to happen, and you knew what he was thinking, but at the same time, you didn't have to see what you already know. And so it left more mystery for the mind.
Isn't the greatest sex scene still considered to be From Here to Eternity with Burt Lancaster? And they're in the water.
Oh, yeah.
You don't see anything, but the water flows over them like with symbolism, and we understand the symbolism, and the mystery is left to be in our imaginations.
And I also think because they don't have romance anymore. You know how guys would have to come to our door and walk to our door, meet our parents, bring us candy, bring us flowers, take us to, you know, dinner and a movie and whatever, you know, and they don't have that romance anymore. And I just think it's such a big thing that's missing in, you know, young kids' lives today where, you know, the guy got out of the car, he opened the door for you going into a restaurant, pulled your chair out. That was a sign of respect for himself and for his female friend. And whether it was a serious date or just a fun date. And we're missing all of that today, especially with, you know, texting and emails. "Hey, will you marry me?" You know, what? Oh. And so, communication, personal communication.
Well, I think what I really see, which really bothers me, because I do read these things on Facebook, is that the lowering of our standards of what we find culturally. We have a culture. people, if you're listening, we do have culture in America. The way we speak, the way we think, how our opinions are formed. And this is used to be taught not just at home, but in the schools. And that's called mores, the cultural, you know, language, all these things. I don't like to see them disappear. So I'm one of those old cranky ladies that writes on Facebook, you know. And
no, my grandson, he was taught since he was a little boy, you know, to do these things and to, you know, you see an old lady in distress to help her, you know, and or a gentleman, whatever, and give up your seat, you know, for them and whatever, you know. And I think that, you know, it's up to the parents now because it's not taught in the public schools, and it's certainly not taught in the movies, you know, the current movies today. And so I think, you know, the parents are going to have to do all the work unless the public schools decide to bring back morals and health and teaching kids self-respect for property and lives and country and all of that. But I don't see that happening in the near future. And so when you talk about these movies, movie stars from the past, they weren't all wealthy when they came from another country or they were here when they wanted to be movie stars. So what about Zsa Zsa Gabor? She was very beautiful and very popular.
Well,
I know
I
you have a story
that
about her.
That's a fascinating story. First of all, nobody knows that the Gabors were Jewish, and they were Hungarian Jews. And people don't – I didn't know this till I began to do some research, but in Hungary – Hungary is one of the last places that Hitler invaded, and he decided he was going to destroy Hungary completely. And they lied to the people. They told them they would be sent to camps and they would survive the war. That was a complete lie because it was a great success, I suppose, for Hitler because he killed 500,000 people. And somehow the Gabors escaped. The father must have had money. He had several jewelry stores. And the mother comes to this country with the daughters. There were three daughters. And I think Zsa Zsa was already married, but she didn't like that husband. And Ava, they were just beautiful. And they knew. They were very poor. They had nothing. They hid their religion, and they hid their poverty. And Ava attached herself to Richard Garland. I write about it in the book. But I think they were boyfriend and girlfriend for quite a while. And she used him. And I think one of the things about Dick that was so nice was that he was so gracious about it because when she dumped him, you know, and she found herself a rich husband, I can't remember, she married Hilton or one of them, you know. She was married 5 times. Zsa Zsa was married 9 times. So, but that was their purpose. That's why Mommy brought them here, and they were survivors. And I had no idea, because I think they used to wear big crosses. I had no idea that they were Jewish until I researched for the book. And that was so interesting. And I'll bet you did. And one of them, I think Ava went with, oh, my God, Merv Griffin. And I don't know if he was gay or straight or what. They never would tell you. But they were together as friends a long, long time. And that's all I knew. And when I went to do pictures on the book, I could not obtain her picture because they were still getting money for her pictures. So therefore, they were all copyrighted, and that's why there's not a picture of the Gabors in the book. But interesting family, and I don't and very little known.
When they came here, though, didn't they live with a specific movie star for quite a while who helped them out?
That was Richard.
That was Richard.
Yeah, it's in the. I think I put it in the book. What happened?
Yeah,
was,
you did because I was trying to remember that particular. Who they were living with at the time, who really helped them out, and because they had no money.
And they actually paid him back.
And they lived there for free, right?
For free.
He let them stay.
Yeah. At that point, he was living in, I think, Chatsworth. He had a beautiful home on acres of land. And they just lived there because what happened was that they lived there till Ava was finally able to land a movie contract. And she was basically supporting the whole family. And then I think they moved out. But he stayed friends with them always. I think that was, to me, the hallmark the most significant thing about Dick, and I'm going to say my Dick was the same way, they understood the business. This is a business of friendship. This is a business of connections. And no matter how badly you are treated, you are always nice. You are always friendly, and you don't complain. Because the moment you do, it's over. It's over. So I read about all these people now that get dropped after so many years and the things that are happening to them. And my heart aches for them.
Yeah, don't they get written up in a... I was told they get put... Their names get put into a little black book. It's a blackballing book where you...
Really?
You're never going to get a part again.
Wow. Well, this I don't... I know that...
Yeah, it was a guy that I used to know, and he was older than me, and he was telling me... back in the 90s, he was telling me he had been in the business doing the camera work for years, and he told me about the little black book that barred people from ever getting a part again if they crossed certain people.
Well, I believe it, because when Dick died, my Dick, 50 years in the business, a pioneer, a famous director, well-known, Joel Tater, came to me. He wanted to write a book about Dick, but Dick kept his mouth shut. You know, he never spoke about anybody, and he saw so many things happen, especially in the studio. You had to do it. You had to do it, because it could come back and bite you any time. And
yes,
that's
and,
how the business works.
I believe it. I mean, because look at how, I mean, they can get a movie star, make a movie star overnight. So how about Gary Cooper? He was so handsome and such a great actor. What, do you have a story about him you can tell?
Well, the story
was simply...
By the
way, we're talking to... Let me say that. We're talking to Judy Watson, and her book is Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood, and it's narrated by Richard Arlen to Maxine Coolidge and edited by the dynamic Judy Watson.
Thank you. But Gary Cooper, the only thing, if you read the chapter on Gary, and there's quite a nice chapter on him, I think the most interesting thing for me was I always thought of him as a cowboy, but he came from a very wealthy family. One of the things he and Dick both had in common was that their fathers were judges in, I think, the superior courts. Gary was well-educated, and one of the things that amazed me, because I'm just this way, I would go and look to see, John Huston, did he leave any money? They're all so famous. What did they leave behind? And Gary Cooper is one of those rare people who left millions of dollars in his estate. But most of them left little but their legacies. And I think I was telling you about Laurel and Hardy. They're famous now, but that's because their pictures were all bought. But they died, and they had little or nothing. The same for Houston. It was a very hard profession to make money, and as the studios began to change to keep that money, and a question you can do history on, I don't know why, but in the 40s, the government began to investigate the studios. They said they were monopolizing. Well, they owned the studios, and they owned the theaters, and somebody got angry. They took them to court, and they broke them apart. And with that, for me, the studio business and industry began to collapse, as people became independent producers and actors got their own agents, and then everybody was a producer and everybody was a director and everybody, you know, could do something, and there was no more ability to go to one place.
I was really surprised when you said that Laurel and Hardy had money and then they died broke.
They died pretty poor. They lived in the valley. Yeah, because I looked them up, too. I didn't put these things into the stories because I thought, that's not a happy ending. But they were pretty anonymous,
right.
And mostly their films had been forgotten. And I hate myself. I can't think of his name, but this man came along. He bought up their movies, bought them all together, and made himself rich and made them famous. But they were dead, and he collected the money. And that is what happened to Laurel and Hardy.
Oh, my goodness. And that happens to a lot of movie actors, not to a lot, but I mean to famous movie actors and actresses that have a lot of money, and then they get a get involved with a bad agent or some other person, a husband or something, and they rip them off, or a wife.
Well,
and
Kirk Douglas's first book, which is, I'll say for Kirk Douglas, I've read bad things, but I tell you, he was a great writer. And his first book, which is all The Rag Picker's Son, I would highly advise reading it. But in that book, he's now, I think, at a stage in the book where he's world famous. He's won all kinds of awards and Oscars. And he finds out that his manager has ripped him off. He has nothing. He has nothing. And he has to begin from zero. And that was when he met the woman who would become his wife. She'd been, an agent. She was smart in the business. She got him lawyers and good people. And after that, he never trusted anyone again. And I think he put his own sons into managing his affairs. And that was how he became wealthy. But, you know, imagine you're at the top of your everything. You've won awards and you're known all over the world, and you discover you're broke. And I think that happens to a lot of them. But, you know, they just don't want to talk about it.
Right. Remember, Debbie Reynolds had a hard time, too, after she got divorced.
Debbie Reynolds married a man who put her in terrible debt, and she trusted him. And I remember that, too. It happens to too many, because I think there's a need when you're an actor to have that admiration. The ego is so different for an actor than it is for a normal person. You need to know that somebody loves you, adores you, likes your presence. Actors will put up with a lot just to be noticed. And therefore, I think they're pretty easy to take advantage of. And so they have to be very careful.
Yeah, I met Sylvester Stallone's mom at a friend's business. She made one-of-a-kind jewelry, and she used to make her headbands and her jewelry for her. And they became good friends. And I lost contact with Michelle, but I still have some of her pieces she gave me when I had my own salon and boutique, skincare salon and boutique. And she was really nice. I really liked her. You could tell she was just a vivacious lady. And I actually met her. I didn't know it was her friend and manager, I guess, of her money. But he was very flirty. Very. And
he was known for that.
I didn't know that, you know, he asked me if I wanted to yacht around the world, you know, go on a worldwide sailing.
You should have said yes, Rose.
No, I'm glad I didn't, because I didn't know that was her friend. And so I just thought he was joking anyway. So, but then later on, I read, I think it was an Inquirer, Globe, or one of those, that he had ripped her off for a lot of money. Yeah, and I was so sad, you know, because who deserves that?
You're talking about
nobody.
His mother.
So, yeah, his mother, Sylvester Stallone's mother, Jackie Stallone. Yeah.
I'll tell you a story. My daughter was very beautiful. She was young. She worked in a very exclusive store down in Malibu called Theodore's. And one day, she's in the store selling, and a man comes in, and I guess he was there at some dining. He used to come in and bring, but he never came alone. He always came surrounded by his buddies. And he comes in to look her over for Sylvester. I loved it. And then he comes back to her and he says, "You're too thin."
Oh.
And I said, "Boy, were you lucky, you know, because he was so big by this time, he didn't approach you. He had his entourage. The girls that he wanted.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. And it was very interesting working down there. She had some very interesting experiences with actors and people that came in. Theodore's is, I think, gone, but it was the kind of store where Elizabeth Taylor would come in and drop $10,000. And we're going back over 20 years ago. And that's the kind of place it was, that the very wealthy, mostly entertainment people and actors like to come in and buy. And she worked there with Harry Belafonte. I think it was Harry Belafonte's daughter and some other people. And it was quite an experience. And she didn't make any money. That's the problem. she got into animation through her brother, became a colorist, and there she began to make money. By the way, for anyone who's knowledgeable or interested, one of the fascinating things to me about animation is that women make exactly the same salaries as men, and that many women are and were, beginning many years ago, producers, directors, writers in animation. So it's a field that never was biased as far as gender goes, and I'm quite sure as far as color goes. And so that was a nice thing I always thought about animation, far better than television. I worked in television, and women didn't have a chance in television way back in the day. It was a totally run male organization.
I listened to Black Lives Matter, and this Marxist organization that believes they're still enslaved, which they are not, but they have no clue that women are a minority, and women of all races in America have had to fight for everything.
Every step of the way.
And you still have to
fight. I knew two female journalists at Channel 5. They were really big. And each of them were fired. And I've spoken with each of them, and they had no clue. Never informed, never told why. And it was horrible. And then they had to go and start all over again. And that's how it was for women. Very, very difficult in the early years.
Well, it still is, because they have the at will now, where they can just let you go at any time for any reason. They don't have to give you a reason. And I was at, I had a friend who managed a major department store, and for 25 years. And all of a sudden, she was crying. She was being walked down by security she had her purse and walked out the door. And so she had no reason. No, they didn't have to give her a reason for letting her go after 25 years. And so she filed a lawsuit, and guess what? She won, and they had to hire her back and put her in a different position, but same pay, and they had to hire her back. So women have to fight back. Online.
I think women always have to be strong and to fight back. I do think, though, I'm going to be very prejudiced here. Right now it's the era of the black woman versus the white woman. And I think we've gone from one extreme to another. I think it should not have anything to do with color or race. I don't care if you're, an Aborigine. If you're a talented person, you should stand up and be counted and be seen. And I wish it would go to that place. And but right now we're just, I'm going to say I didn't see black people working in the business, but then I didn't see Latino people in the business. I didn't see Asian people in the business. And I was in the background. I worked for the chief engineer. I was only associated with engineers, people that did the, ran the place, not maintenance, but the people that maintained all the engineering, that did the videotape, that were the editors. The cameramen, the producers, the directors, the audio men, it was all men, and it was all white men.
Well,
I'm going to be honest
here. Same with the court system and lawyers, too. Women didn't start breaking into the judicial system in law school, and it was difficult until the late 90s, when so many women, after the no-fault divorce that you mentioned before, found themselves without an education.
Stranded.
And without,
I remember that era, because
without
I,
a job,
yeah.
And
yeah.
Their husbands weren't paying support, so there they were. So they picked themselves up, and they decided to go to college and fight back by becoming lawyers and judges.
I worked in a law firm for about 9 years. We had two women attorneys. They were paid a third less than the men. This is back in the 80s. And they worked just as hard, and they had just as good a degree. They just didn't get the money.
Yeah, my friend was an engineer, and the same thing happened to her, too. But we have to close, unfortunately. We've run out of time. But I do want to thank Judy Watson so much for giving us such fun and invaluable information and facts. And you have to find her book, Wings and Other
recollections
of early Hollywood. And just look up Wings and Judy Watson online, and you will find
it. It's on Amazon.
And Judy,
it's Barnes and Noble. It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Yes, it's everywhere, and Amazon's the easiest place to find it. And so, Judy, do you have a message before we close for our audience?
Well, I think my message would be try not to be dispirited in this time. Try to understand that we're living in a very tense political environment. Question everything. Take nothing for granted. And even as you grow older, and certainly I am old, you have the right to say, what is this? Why is this? And I always do one thing. You're going to hate me. Every time I see something on television, I immediately go to the internet and I say to myself and to them, who puts the money up for this? And I believe that there are people at work with a lot of money who are instigating what I see as anarchy and what I see as, I don't care if you like Trump, I don't care if you like Biden, just let them run honest campaigns. Let us have the agreement to disagree. Let us not degrade each other, despise each other, and do the inhuman things I see all around me. It's just another president, another time. We will get through it, and we will get through COVID too. Okay?
Thank you so much, Judy Watson. Those are great, wise words. And Judy isn't old, so don't listen to her about that. She's young at heart and spirit, and she's still going, and that's what everyone needs to do, because she just gave you a message that it's about love and respect for each other, and if we don't have that, we can't have peace, and we need peace in the world. So spread more love. Stop the hate. Spread more love.
Yeah.
Help each other. People helping people. Thank you so much, Judy. I'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Love you, Rose. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that's all we have time for. Judy Watson has left the building, and I have to leave the building. So God bless you. God bless America. God bless everyone who may be affected with COVID. But remember, 95% of the people or more, according to the CDC, recover. Hey, there's always hope. There's always God. And that's what you should be looking up to and kneeling to. Kneel down to nobody. Kneel down to God. Praise God. Thank God. God will heal you. Just ask him and you'll find out. And I'll talk to you again on Wednesday, 12 to noon. This is The Rose signing off. Bye-bye.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or, if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.